From Cafe, welcome to Cafe Insider. I'm Preet Bharara.
And I'm Ann Milker.
Hi, Ann. Any aquariums this week?
No aquariums this week.
Wow.
Little pumpkin, not picking. I don't know. Does it count as pumpkin picking if you go to the grocery store and buy one?
No, it does not.
Pumpkin acquisition.
How could that count?
We were gonna
as pumpkin picking.
We were going to pick and then it rained.
Right. Pumpkin purchasing. So can we talk about Twitter for a second?
Yes.
So there was a reporter who did a profile of Mitt Romney named McKay Coppins. And it's a nice big profile in The Atlantic. And there's a lot of reporting on the fact that Mitt Romney admitted that he has a secret Twitter account where he lurks. And based on the information that he gave, number of followers and some other common sense things, the same person who found once upon a time Jim Comey's secret Twitter, Ashley Feinberg at Slate, found the secret Mitt Romney Twitter account.
It's going to be like a whole new class at journalism school.
how to avoid
secret Twitter.
Well, and how to keep it secret. And apparently he has this Twitter account in the name Pierre Delecto.
I don't know why that name makes me laugh.
It's kind of funny. At QAWS9876. So I thought that was kind of funny. Follows 702 people.
That's a lot, actually.
Yeah.
How many followers?
Guess who one of those people he follows is?
Donald Trump.
Me.
Oh, Preet. Congratulations.
Mitt Romney's secret account. I'm kind of tickled by that.
Do you follow him? Not to put you on the spot.
So I tried. Because now he has made his account private.
Yeah.
And so I put in a follow request, which is pending.
Ooh. Your application is pending.
With Mitt Romney, my application is pending.
Interesting.
So I don't know. It's a lot, but it's not that many.
Do you know what's funny? I have a secret Twitter account.
You have a secret Twitter? I would not reveal any more information about it.
I never tweeted from it. I had one years ago before I was sure if I would ever want to tweet, and I just followed news and such.
Right. So that was
cool. I'm not telling you anymore.
Here's my question. So I found out about another Twitter follower.
Yes.
Yesterday as well. And I'm wondering which one you think is cooler.
Okay.
So we got the Mitt Romney.
Yeah. Pretty great.
AKA Pierre Delecto. And then Ben Stiller began following me.
Oh.
That's cool.
Also
right?
Pretty cool. Yeah. Yeah.
Look, these are the small things that make me happy.
Yes.
All right. Should we talk about serious stuff?
Yes.
Serious stuff happened this week? I think it did.
Yes.
First, should we talk about the acting chief of staff, Mick Mulvaney?
I don't want to call him acting. You know why I don't like the acting thing?
Why?
Because
it doesn't make any sense.
It's Donald Trump's choice to make him an acting. And
there's no Senate confirmation.
Yeah. And he could pick someone tomorrow. And so it feels to me when we say like he's acting as though he's less responsible as the chief of staff. But the bottom line is he's the chief of staff. He's been the chief of staff for 10 months. And to me, there's a lot of tough things about being acting, but here it's a choice.
I totally endorse that position. Like, for example, am I your acting co-host or am
no,
I your co-host?
You're my co-host.
Right?
Yeah.
Full on. About 10 months too.
And Donald Trump. And Donald Trump, you can't have everyone or a lot of people in acting positions and then be like, oh, they're just acting. I mean, he's the chief of staff for all purposes.
The person is acting because it means that they don't have Senate confirmation yet. That's different.
Yeah. But it's also, if you choose not to nominate someone and keep your acting in for a really long time, you're also making a choice. So yes, it's a little different, but I sort of think we're making too much of the acting. So anyway, Mick Mulvaney, yes. The head of the office.
The chief of staff.
Yes.
And he's got like five other jobs too.
And the head of office of management and budget.
One job that maybe he's not good at acting at, spokesperson.
Yes.
Not so good at the spoking.
Agreed.
Mick Mulvaney. So two things happened. We'll go through each of them because I think they're important. They're actually relevant, I think, legally going forward and will be of consequence to the House. One is the Trump Doral G7 announcement. And the second is what he had to say about quid pro quo. So on Doral, we've been talking for a while about how Donald Trump wants to direct business to his own properties. And it's one thing that people don't like, that he goes to his properties virtually every weekend, taxpayer expense, and the Secret Service has to go and everything else. But in this case, I think people are correct to say when Donald Trump announces that the next G7 in June of 2020 will be at his Trump Doral property, that is essentially being involved with personally and directing business to yourself on a no-bid contract, which if anyone else did that, you'd get in trouble. For example, when you were the Attorney General of New Jersey, if you had a bail bonds business.
Yes. I did not, but yes.
So, but you sure you didn't have a secret thing?
I'm positive.
So, but if you did and you directed people to send defendants who were under arrest and needed to make bail to your bail bonds business, would that have been unethical?
Yes.
Okay.
Even if I said, I'm going to do it at cost, which is what the president said, which what does that even mean?
I don't
right?
know what it means.
Yeah. And there's so many things that are wrong with this. I mean, the first is that it's the president's property and he's self-dealing and he had made a commitment that they wouldn't use his property for anything when he was running for office. And at the end of the day, it's corruption to send it to yourself. Yeah. Even if he said, I will take no money, there is a brand benefit. There is a huge you're making foreign governments pay money, ostensibly, right, to which is a, you know, we'll talk about the emoluments clauses of the Constitution, but there's a foreign emoluments clause saying that the president can't accept anything of value, essentially, from foreign governments. He can't take a title. He can't take money. And there's a domestic emoluments clause saying that the president also cannot benefit financially from getting anything other than his salary as president. So there's just a huge problem with this. And what is almost most astonishing to me, and I wanted to ask you about this, is that the president doubles down a lot. So he's doing something wrong, or he's doing something that crosses a norm or a law or an ethics rule. And then he goes even deeper. So we've been talking about the Doral. He made mention of it over the summer. There was a huge outcry against it. And then he does it.
But, you know, separate from what you're saying about it being self-dealing, the way in which it came about makes it even worse. Because as he said, as you referenced, during the campaign, he was not going to be involved in his business. I mean, one of the reasons he justified not divesting himself, so I'm not going to be involved. And here, he's basically boasting about being involved and saying that he was part of the decision-making. He basically directed it. It would still be bad and still be awful and still should have been canceled if it was some independent process of him and he, you know, holed up in the White House and let other people decide. That's still, I think, bad, and I still think has ethical problems and consequences. But here he is basically saying to the world, this is where I want to have it. And what do you think the underlings do when they're deliberating over where to have it? And then they give all these reasons, including
that are all pretextual.
The airport.
Yeah.
And it became apparent at the end of that process that Doral was by far and away the best physical facility for this meeting. In fact, I was talking to one of the advance teams when they came back, and I said, what was it like? And he said, Mick, you're not going to believe this, but it's almost like they built this facility to host this type of event.
Meanwhile, this is an amazing thing that I see over and over and over again. I think people are getting sick of it, finally. Then when President Trump changes his mind and blames the Democrats on it, when it's clear that he understood this was a terrible idea and Republicans wouldn't countenance it either, I saw people supporting Trump on social media by saying, well, the real reasons are, it turns out it's not a great location because of the heat, because, you know, it's too close to the airport and you have planes flying overhead and you can't close out the airspace, trying to justify why this was not a good place when Donald Trump had people come forward and say, essentially, Mick Mulvaney has said this.
It's the best place.
It's the best place. It's as if this place was built for the G7.
And the funny thing about the weather is that the weather is pretty similar in the summer in Florida. So nothing has changed about that. The weather's always kind of hot
hotter,
and sticky.
It's a little hotter.
Yeah, not my favorite place to be in the summer. But the fascinating part about this is I was thinking, I don't know if you have a view on this, but it does feel to me like in a lot of administrations, the president is surrounded by people who generally are strong, and there's a little bit of a check on the worst impulses, right? And I'm not saying Trump is the first president to have bad impulses, but there's usually a process.
But he has the worst impulses.
Yes, he is the worst. But there's also usually a process that is built around the president to make sure that there's, you know, terrible ideas don't just get done. And here it feels like Trump says it. This is a terrible idea, both legally and frankly, politically. It just feels to me like this is the why buy trouble.
Can I interrupt here so we can do a quick aside? Because you've raised the issue of being able to prevent Donald Trump from going forward on his bad impulses. And it occurs to me that we should pause on this discussion of Mulvaney and briefly consider the letter that Donald Trump proudly sent to President Erdogan of Turkey, speaking of bad impulses that are not prevented.
Well,
do you remember this? Are you going to read this letter for us? We have gotten some requests. We now get requests in the same way famous musicians get requests for their best songs or covers. We now get requests on the Twitter. And by the way, can I say once again, can I do a disclaimer? Anne and I laugh. It's not funny. It's terrible. What's happening with Turkey and Syria is terrible and awful. But, you know, I can't live my life unless I can laugh a little bit at some of this stuff. So please bear with us. So it's a letter that the president sent to President Erdogan that was then revealed some days later. And I think it's been reported that when the president met with top Democrats in the White House, he was proud of the letter and revealed it to them to show how strong he was and how he's not going to take any guff from that Turkish guy.
That's right. And I mean, just to go back to this, I didn't believe it was true. You texted it to me and I'm looking at our text back and forth, and you sent it to me before it had sort of really broken hugely in the news. And I did not believe you. And I trust you, of course, but it was like my first reaction was, this is impossible. And just before I read this, also to the point of who's in charge, in a million years as a staff member for any member of Congress, senator, president, you would never let this letter go out, I think.
No, you would not.
You would not. So this is a letter sent by President Trump to the Turkish President Erdogan. And it's from Donald Trump. It's on White House stationery, which was the one thing I thought made it look very official. Dear Mr. President, let's work out a good deal. You don't want to be responsible for slaughtering thousands of people. And I don't want to be responsible for destroying the Turkish economy. And I will.
Are you using your ominous voice?
I'm getting ready for Halloween. I've already given you a little sample with respect to Pastor Brunson. I have worked hard to solve some of your problems. Don't let the world down. You can make a great deal. General Maslum is willing to negotiate with you, and he is willing to make concessions that they would never have made in the past. I am confidentially enclosing a copy of his letter to me just received. History will look upon you favorably if you get this done the right and humane way. It will look upon you. this is the part that really gets me.
Yeah.
It will look upon you forever as the devil if good things don't happen. Don't be a tough guy. Don't be a fool. I'll call you later. That's my other favorite part. Like,
I will call you later.
I'll call you later.
Sincerely, Donald Trump.
Sincerely, Donald Trump.
It's like you do this whole threatening thing. He's like, hey, you up?
Catch you soon.
Miss you.
I also love like the erratic, like, let's, like the encouraging, let's make a deal to, I will crush you. I will crush your economy.
And I don't think he's followed through. All right, so shall we go back to the main theme?
Yes.
topic
Let's go
we were
back
talking
to
about.
Mick Mulvaney.
To Mick Mulvaney. And so,
who, by the way, let that letter go out as chief of staff?
Yeah, I think nobody can stop the president when he wants to do something. And then, by the way, as we see with Trump Doral, they're forced to go out there and say it's wonderful, it's great, it's a perfect conversation, it's a beautiful conversation, it's a perfect resort, it's built for the G7. And then when Trump pulls the rug out from under them, they just look foolish. You know, I'll say, I've been thinking about this more. There's one dimension in which you criticize the people who work for the president for not adhering to proper ethical standards and, you know, for enabling him in various ways. But there's something even more fundamental, depending on how much self-respect you have. What I don't understand is the people who continue to work there, and this is not even about ideology or policy or laws or anything else. It's about simple self-respect. And if you have a president or any kind of boss who humiliates you on a regular basis, I don't understand how you keep coming to work.
Yeah.
Right? That happened with Jeff Sessions. Jeff Sessions, whatever you think of him, he was humiliated publicly by the president of the United States on a regular basis, kept coming to work.
Yeah. And by some accounts, still defends the president. One of the things I've been thinking a lot about is that it really is a terrible thing that one of two things is happening, and maybe both. One is that the president is completely running the show without any input or listening to other folks. The other, which I think is equally possible, is that they're all a little bit tone deaf. The idea that you would release this letter and think it is positive in showing your strength as you abandon the Kurds in Syria, it feels to me just beyond belief. And so there's something wrong that's happening. And to your point, also, look, I'm a big believer in government that one of the things that's critical is that when you work for someone, you have to have a voice, you have to be heard, and then whatever decision gets made, you adopt that decision like it was yours as long as it's ethical and lawful and fair. And so it's not to say that you shouldn't run 100% behind the lead decision maker, even if they make decisions you disagree with. As long as you're heard and those decisions are lawful and valid, that's what you do. This is the complete opposite of that. It also appears like the president just goes out and says stuff, and then his staff, it's a completely different function than staff has ever had. Like, they now have to go out and create a policy around what he said versus having a process that creates a policy that the president announces.
Yeah,
it's
no,
the reverse.
It's very parallel to what George Conway and I talked about with respect to apparently some editing fiascos that they had on The Apprentice, where they would tape for hours and hours and hours, and he said, Donald Trump would then fire someone on a whim, and it turned out that was like the best person. And so they're like, oh shit, he fired the guy, and that was the person who had the best business ideas. So they would have to reverse engineer that decision.
To make the person look bad?
Yes, and like take out the good stuff and make other people look worse. That was a TV show.
Yeah.
And you see that's happening.
In the United States.
That's happening here. And so then, what do you make of the fact that Donald Trump very famously doesn't back down from anything? I can count two significant things on which there's been some retreat. The first was the separations at the border, which still have not been solved, but
And he's still doing it, but to a much lesser extent. It's different, but he's still doing it.
Because of the outcry.
Yes.
And then there's this thing. And the thing I think about this thing is it was really simple. It was not a partisan issue.
Yes.
It was easy for the public to understand. And you had members of his own party. He doesn't care what any Democrats think or progressives think. But you had a bunch of people, and the reporting was behind the scenes, they were telling him, you need to undo this. Because it just looks like blatant self-dealing.
Yeah.
And I really feel that that people will forgive lots of things with respect to someone whose points they believe in or they otherwise support. But blatant self-dealing, I know that from my public corruption cases, people just can't abide it.
Yeah, it's corruption. I mean, if it looks like corruption and smells like corruption and walks like corruption, it's corruption.
It's a duck.
It's a duck. And that feels to me like this one was simple in a way that there are a lot of ones that the president can also spin. This one, to me, felt impossible to spin. At the end of the day, the president's resort was getting the business.
And yet people tried to spin it.
Yeah.
And then not only did they try to spin it, and the reason we're spending a lot of time on this, I think, is because it's just a microcosm of how the White House works. But not only did they spin it, then when the president says otherwise, they spin it the other way around.
Right.
And they try to blame the Democrats, and they try to blame the media.
Do you know what's bad about this whole thing, Preet? It's both a victory in many ways because the president was about to do something corrupt, but it also shows you that Republicans have power over
Yes.
the president and that they've chosen not to exercise it. And that disturbs me because it's clear they sent the message to him, we're not with you, and he reversed not because the media and the crazy Democrats, as the president calls them, were saying something, but because his own party was going to go against him on it. And so it shows the power of Republicans right now to actually change how the world is working. And the fact that many of them are not doing that is deeply troubling because it's not enough for them to say, well, we can't. And by the way, you know, your friend Mitt Romney has said things like this also. The Senate is powerless. Like, people have sort of argued Congress doesn't have that much authority. But you look at this one small example, people who are politically elected as Republicans having tremendous influence over the president. That's also, by the way, true of family separations where there were Republican members of Congress and governors who came out against the family separations. And there was sort of an overall cry against it. And so the president, it can be influenced. It just requires that the Republicans do the influencing.
One or two more points on the Doral issue. I think every time Mick Mulvaney opens his mouth, he says something that is really harmful to the president, which I'm not saying he should stop doing that, because I think he's speaking the truth about the president, how he thinks about things. He had this extraordinary interview with Chris Wallace on Fox News. I don't know why these guys continue to go on with Chris Wallace, by the way, because they never come out looking good. Stephen Miller.
I agree.
Mick Mulvaney, anyone else. So I guess maybe they get points for trying. And when he's trying to explain what the president was thinking here and why he was personally involved, he says, essentially, the president thinks of himself as in the hospitality business. And Chris Wallace is like, dude, he's the president of the United States. It's not a side gig.
Right.
The president isn't one for holding back his feelings and his emotions about something. He was honestly surprised at the level of pushback. At the end of the day, you know, he still considers himself to be in the hospitality business. And he saw an opportunity to take the biggest leaders from around the world. And he wanted to put on the absolute best show, the best visit that he possibly could.
And Mulvaney kind of revealed an enduring truth, that the president really doesn't fully think of himself as the president and separate from his business. It's all the same thing. And he thought that was a way to explain away in good faith, in a good-natured way, why the president did this thing.
But it makes it worse.
Much worse.
Yeah, I agree with that. It's also sometimes their defenses, it's really hard to understand what they think is going to come out of that. If the president wants to be in the hospitality business, he doesn't have to be the president. You know, it's also not that complicated. If you want to pitch for business at the G7, you are not president of the United States and you pitch for business at the G7.
Sometimes the explanations are true. And that's damaging to the president because it shows what's really going on. And sometimes the explanations are patently false and ridiculous, like when they say that the reason he called President Zelensky from Ukraine was because he cared about corruption generally and not, as we now understand and appreciate, he cared about specifically having dirt on his main political rival.
One thing, the last thing I'd say about Mulvaney, and then we should talk about what Mulvaney said about the quid pro quo. He sounds to me like he parrots the language and views of Donald Trump more than almost anyone else who speaks on behalf of the president. And so one of the interesting things is that if you sort of took Mulvaney out of it, it could have been Donald Trump giving a quick presser on his way to catch a flight somewhere, right? I mean, it sounded a lot like Donald Trump and the way that he frames things and the arguments he uses. So he's a little bit in the Trump bubble. And so I agree, he does a terrible job. It was an outrageously bad press conference, but it's also very similar to, I think, the arguments that Donald Trump himself would make.
You know who I think is very diminished, more diminished than others? Marco Rubio, who once upon a time, I think, had a good beat on the president and what he was like. And he sort of blithely said, yeah, it's good for Florida. Why not? I don't care much of it. And you would think that Republicans would get the message after a while when they defend the president and they come up with silly excuses like for Trump Doral or anything else, and then they get left holding the bag. Maybe the next time they won't do it. And maybe that's a little bit what happened with Trump Doral. There were some people like Rubio who was like, nothing to see here. This seems wonderful and fantastic and great for Florida.
Yeah.
But there were others who I think have learned the lesson. We're not going to defend something that's indefensible, especially if it's going to be canceled. And then we look very silly.
Yes. It also is to your point that we've started to see members of the public going to these town hall meetings and asking their members of Congress these questions. And that's, I think it's an impossible question to answer. And also we should note that the Trump Doral has never been selected before for the G7.
It has never been selected before.
If it was really the perfect place, you would think it would have been at the top of the list before. And so I'm not saying that they can't pick a new place, but there's so many difficulties, I think,
even
in
arguing
for it.
Even though it was made for the G7?
In August.
It seems to have been.
Florida, yes.
All right, so quid pro quo. Mick Mulvaney comes out, does a briefing, and basically says that one of the reasons why we withheld the funds was we wanted them to do an investigation with respect to the DNC. This is talking about Ukraine.
Yeah.
And then everyone freaks out, mm-hmm. including Republicans. And by the way, this is very telling, including the White House folks, not for attribution.
The lawyers.
And then the lawyers for attribution. You know, Jay Sekulow, who basically defends everything that the president does or people around the president does, says we were not involved in preparing for that briefing in any way, shape, or form, which I thought was an interesting articulation of their involvement. Not, it's not true, but we weren't involved as if...
This isn't our defense, right?
Yeah,
this
as
is
if a, the sin was...
We're not adopting this.
The language as opposed to the truth of it.
Yes. And then the Department of Justice freaks out.
Yes.
And we'll talk about that separately in a second, but issues one of the few statements they've issued on any of these matters saying, it's news to us that this had anything to do with any investigation that we may be conducting into the 2016 election or the origins of the Mueller investigation. So this moment last week, and I don't, you know, get whipsaw that much, even though the defenses keep changing. It's not surprising in some ways that the defenses keep changing. But this one to me was unbelievable. It was from the president and his surrogate saying repeatedly, there's no quid pro quo, to, yeah, there's a quid pro quo. And we're proud of that quid pro quo.
Get over it.
Get over it. And we do it all the time.
It's a get over it.
If you read the news reports and you believe them, what did McKinney say yesterday? Well, McKinney said yesterday that he was really upset with the political influence in foreign policy. That was one of the reasons he was so upset about this. And I have news for everybody. Get over it. There's going to be political influence in foreign policy.
And this made me feel a little like, you know, the sort of analogy I was thinking a little bit about, and it's not perfect, but, you know, your kid, you tell your kid you can't have cookies. You hear the jar break or the something fall. You go into the kitchen. Your child has chocolate all over their face. And you say, did you eat a cookie? And your child says, no, I didn't eat a cookie. Or your child says, like, there's some range of excuses. This is the equivalent of your child being like, damn right I ate a cookie. It was delicious. It's my favorite kind of cookie.
Get
and I'll
over
eat it.
It
again tomorrow. Get over it, right? It's like, it's so bold and outrageous to be like you. It almost made me stop in my tracks.
I like the cookie analogy, but I really prefer it when you do
penguins.
Analogies involving penguins. Yeah.
It's like you stole a penguin.
And damn right, that's my penguin. I think that's actually the same analogy we used last time.
But think about it. It's an astonishing thing. And there are a couple of sort of high-level pieces also that are worth focusing on. It's kind of hard to argue that you have a valid defense when your defense keeps changing and when part of your defense is, I had every right to do what I did. And it is a little bit consistent with the president saying it's a perfect call. There is sort of a line of this that is familiar. The other thing that's weird, just to raise this, is that they thought a lot about it, because what Mulvaney is saying is, yes, there was a quid pro quo as it related to an investigation of the 2016 election. He tries to say it had nothing to do with the Bidens or Burisma, the company for which Hunter Biden was on the board, which is totally contradicted by the memorandum of the call itself. So it, we know that's false. In some ways, they're trying to thread the needle to basically say, yeah, this is about investigating past corruption, not about trying to influence the future election. But any way you look at it, they're investigating political rivals.
So one thing I think is extremely significant with respect to the legal arguments and how this will play out with respect to impeachment is when Mulvaney says this thing, as we've been discussing, that, yeah, we did it. We had an exchange. It happens all the time. Get over it. Everyone freaks out. And the fact that everyone freaked out, including the legal team, to me indicates that they are well aware of and completely recognize and acknowledge that a quid pro quo is bad.
Yes.
So we had always predicted that at some point they're going to take the position that Mulvaney did briefly. But yeah, if there's an exchange, there's nothing wrong with that. They are not taking that position going forward.
Yeah.
The fact that they made him, you know, walk back his statement, the fact that he claims he didn't say what we all saw he said, and Chris Wallace, I think, showed him up on that, means that this issue of quid pro quo, even though I continue to say, I think you agree, not necessary for an article of impeachment, the abuse of power is there based on the request without an exchange, without a quid pro quo. But the proof that keeps mounting that there was a quid pro quo with respect to Ukraine is absolutely devastating to the president's position.
Right. I agree. I think that there is evidence that there was a quid pro quo, and I think that there will be additional evidence that the House committees uncover. And so I would favor having two articles of impeachment on this, one on the sort of broader concept of the president's duty to not do things for personal political gain, but also a quid pro quo article. What is astonishing about it as a defense, too, is that it sort of assumes something. And I think that part of their bet was, yes, the United States argues all the time, we want you to do this in exchange for that. But they forget that they do that on behalf of the good of the United States, not on behalf of the president's personal political benefit. And so there's a huge distinction, and they're in trying to sort of combine all that together, it just looks absurd. And if Mulvaney's position were right, then the president could do anything he wanted, essentially. He could leverage any amount of congressional funding in exchange for his own personal benefit. And that simply cannot be the way that the United States works.
Yeah, I mean, they keep trying to normalize this term quid pro quo to mean something it doesn't mean when you're talking about corruption. Exchanges happen all the time. That is the basis for the economy. That's how capitalism works. Every time you walk into a store and you buy a cookie to keep the cookies going.
Yeah, I love cookies.
Or a penguin for that matter, if you can buy a penguin.
I haven't bought one lately, but
at a pet store, you give them money. They give you the thing that you paid for with the money. That is a quid pro quo, I guess. In every walk of life,
you're
have an exchange. And as you point out, the difference is, I mean, everyone understands. I mean, the president has some murkiness to work with because everyone does understand. If he said, we're not going to give you the aid in Ukraine unless, you know, you agree to help me build a hotel in Ukraine, that's so much more direct. People get that. If you said, we're not going to give you the $431 million in aid unless you give my campaign $500,000, that's A, illegal because it's foreign money, but also you understand how directly it relates to his personal benefit. Here, they're grasping at straws a little bit to suggest that the benefit that the president was asking for was in the general interest of the country. It was anti-corruption. You know, but people have common sense, and they know when the only human being you mention in the conversation is Joe Biden, and Joe Biden happens to be, I don't know if it's still the case, but at that point it was, leading in the polls as his rival for the Democratic nomination, then it's very clear that it's for personal benefit.
I mean, and by the way, the whole argument that this is for corruption in general, it is part of a cover-up. I mean, they're trying to couch it in these terms in order to prevent people from seeing that it wasn't about corruption in general, which the U.S. has been fighting against in Ukraine for many years. It's about this specific incident that they wanted investigated. And Preet, I wanted to sort of go to the DOJ piece with you just for a second because this crystallized something for me. So Mulvaney argues they want help with the 2016 election, and we've talked about this, that the president believes this now heavily debunked conspiracy theory that somehow the Democratic servers that were hacked by the Russians ended up in Ukraine or that there were Ukrainians involved in this. There's no basis at all for that belief other than the fact that a couple of conspiracy theorists had put it out there and it got a little traction and apparently it got traction with the president. But there's no basis for that. So that's a piece of this. What Mulvaney seems to be saying is he goes a step further to connect that theory with the investigation that the Attorney General Bill Barr has the Connecticut U.S. Attorney John Durham doing into whether the investigation into the president in 2016 was legitimately started or whether there was bias in the FBI against the president, against the president's campaign. So Mulvaney connects those two together, potentially in part because he knows that the first piece of this related to the Democratic servers has been totally debunked. But he does this in a way that basically makes it seem like the president of the United States is going out and personally working on an investigation, a criminal investigation. And for some reason, it crystallized this for me for the first time of the president can't investigate people, right? And they're supposed to be arm's length with the attorney general because it's supposed to be independent. And yes, the president's the chief executive, but
it's the ultimate paradox. To the extent that they say the spirit of their investigation now is to see if there was bias in the commencing of the investigation relating to Russia, you are now imposing the bias of a person who wants retaliation and who has made a conclusion in advance on that point. The president believes that so. The president himself is biased. The president himself should stay the hell out of it. Case closed.
Yeah, case closed. The last thing to say about the Mulvaney presser, which I thought was really interesting, is that it's also important to remember that this wasn't money that the president was giving. It was money that was appropriated by Congress, the almost $400 million. And what's important about that is in Mulvaney's press conference, he even acknowledges that it's a violation of the law for the executive branch to, quote, impound. There's a whole statute related to impounding money that Congress has legitimately authorized. And so there's an awareness of what they're doing that I didn't fully appreciate until I saw his press conference, but he knows they're holding money that Congress has legitimately said, we want it to go out, and they've put the brakes on that. And so there's an awareness of that quid pro quo piece that I hadn't seen prior to the press conference.
See, I compare that to Australia, which is not as bad, right? Look, if you're on this issue of what the president is asking for and what he's seeking and how much personal benefit he's trying to get, there are gradations, right? We know about this phone call that the president had with the leader of Australia, which I think is also weird and also unseemly. But, you know, the argument in favor of that being legitimate is that there's an existing investigation that's going on and he's merely seeking the help of, you know, a foreign power to aid generally in an investigation that's happening. And I see, you know, why people make that point and people try to connect it to this letter that three Democratic senators sent to Ukraine about having them cooperate with the Mueller investigation. The difference, I think, is the president of the United States has a deep-seated personal interest in the result of one versus not.
Yeah.
And so, you know, when you're asking people to cooperate with and help out with, as international comedy may require, something like the special counsel's investigation, which, by the way, was set in motion.
Oh, you said comedy, not comedy.
C-O-M-I-T-I. Sometimes it's C-O-M-I-T-I.
Wait, I had to, okay, I'm with you.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
No, international cooperation.
I do a lot of stand-up comedy. That was, in many ways, however much the president was trying to debunk it, set in motion by his administration, was overseen by his attorney general, his deputy attorney general, and had the full support of the Justice Department. And so I don't think they're really equivalent.
I don't think so either. I think also that the idea of the executive branch, someone in the executive branch saying, hey, we expect full cooperation with legitimate and lawful investigations in our country, that conversation has been happening forever. And generally speaking, we get varying levels as a country of cooperation depending on who the other country is. This is different, though. The president here is looking for an investigation, one, to discredit the Mueller investigation, and two, basically, you know, what we know from his call with Zelensky, and again, we have to go back to what the actual facts are, is that he's looking for an investigation into the DNC servers and into, which again is a conspiracy theory that's been debunked, and into the Bidens and this company Burisma related to Hunter Biden. And so it is about his personal political gain. It's not about just look for the good of all, let's do political corruption investigations, and we want you to help us when we do them. But you're right, there's enough there that allows the Republicans to basically say, hey, why is it okay for the Democrats to ask for help with Mueller, and it's not okay for the president to ask for help with you know, Biden and the DNC servers and the 2016 investigation.
Yeah, I think they can quickly dispense with that argument because it doesn't hold up. So should we get to impeachment? We should talk about what's going on in the House. Lots of developments over the last week. To begin with, I think people have some confusion over what powers the House committees have. They have subpoena power, we've discussed. That's limited as far as it goes because you can defy it and then you have to fight in court. So far, there's not been an appetite to put people under arrest, hold them in inherent contempt. But someone who pays careful attention, a listener, has this question. It's from William A. Miller. He says, the White House has clearly indicated a lack of cooperation in responding to subpoenas. Does Congress have the authority to seek search warrants, in parentheses, nuclear option, to forcibly obtain information? Is this contained within the inherent contempt authority? #AskPreet. So that's an important thing for people to understand, that as a criminal investigator, when you and I had those powers, you have all sorts of abilities, not just to issue subpoenas, but to conduct surveillance, to do wiretapping, to put bugs in people's offices, you know, with approval from a court, and to execute search warrants. So imagine if, as a criminal prosecutor, the only power you had was a subpoena, lots and lots of criminal activity would not be able to be prosecuted in a timely way.
Right, and a lot of evidence would be destroyed.
Correct. Congress does not have the ability to seek search warrants, as far as I know.
Yeah, I looked this up. It's a great listener question. I looked it up a week or two ago when I thought, you know, if I were doing the investigation, I would just drop a search warrant on the State Department, on the Pentagon, on the Office of Management and Budget, particularly because you want the underlying documents here. You want to see what the paper is going back and forth. And I looked up, can Congress execute a search warrant? And I didn't find a single thing that said that they can't. So it would take a pretty creative and aggressive legal argument for them to go in. But I think they also would have to go through a court. So let's be clear that the only way you can ever get a search warrant is to go to a court. And so—
Yeah, but I don't think there's anything that authorizes Congress to do anything. I mean,
exactly.
More what they have is, you know, what civil litigants have when they sue each other and they get discovery. There are subpoenas that are issued in those cases
exactly.
As well.
You go to the judge and say they have not complied with the subpoena. And so there is a path here for Congress to get those documents. And that path is to go to the district court and basically say there's been a failure to comply. And so I think that's the mechanism that's imagined here. And again, I think it does matter because even the witnesses who are agreeing to testify, even though the administration has said, and a lot of the members of the administration, particularly the political appointees, have refused to come in, many of them. But a number of people have come in, particularly the employees of the State Department and other branches of government who are long-term government employees. They have come in, but they have not, as a rule, brought documents. Some have, but a lot of them have said, for example, it's up to the State Department to provide those documents to you. And so it does matter for Congress to get their hands on the documents.
Here's another question that gets to something that you and I have been discussing for a while. Maybe we should spend a couple of minutes on what the breadth of the articles of impeachment should be. This comes from a listener by email, Maya, who says, given the long list of potentially impeachable actions by the president, what is the best strategy for Congress? Should they only pursue the single issue with Syria? Or should Congress list all of the offenses they believe are impeachable and send on to the Senate, assuming the House votes to impeach? So this is a question that prosecutors deal with all the time in criminal cases. If you've got the ability to make a case with 12 counts or 34 counts, do you charge them all? You just proceed with a streamlined indictment. I think it depends on the circumstances of the case. You know, one of the first lessons I learned was, as a matter of strategy in a criminal case, if you can avoid having only one count, avoid it. So my first trials was a case involving a felon in possession of a firearm, which is unlawful. But the strategic thinking goes that if you only give the jury one choice and they get hung up, they might not have something on which they can compromise. So you'll often see prosecutors bring, you know, a tough count and then some lesser counts and some other related counts under different statutes. And the thinking often there is maybe some people will vote to acquit on some, but convict on others. You want to give them something of a choice.
I agree. I agree with that. I also think you don't want to give them 100 counts. And as a rule, one of the things I did a lot as a supervisor was significantly pare down indictments. So I agree you don't want one count. And it is helpful to have counts, particularly where there's very clear wrongdoing and you believe it's very clear that the evidence will support it. It's helpful to include those counts. But when you have 100 counts, it ends up, you listen to 100 jury charges, first of all, and the time you spend at the end can go on for hours, but it also makes it more complicated in some ways when you want to be able to say to a jury, look, here's what happened. Pretty simple, straightforward thing. And it could be a couple different things that have happened, but 100 is too many. And so
you want to be careful about your long shots, which is not to say if there have been five robberies, and with respect to one robbery, the evidence is not quite as strong, you don't want to let them off because you believe that there's proof beyond a reasonable doubt if it's a little weaker. On the other hand, if you have a weak legal theory, but you think it's a possibility that you're going to get a conviction on it, you don't do that.
Right.
Because, you know, a good defense lawyer doesn't necessarily methodically attack every single thing. They pick their spots and they find the way in which you've overreached. They can argue to the jury and they say, well, they've overreached here, and you bang the drum on that for most of your summation. And then the hope is that the jury has lost, I think, trust and confidence in the prosecution's strategy overall, and they vote with the defendant. And I think here, when it's not a criminal trial, it's a political process that requires public sentiment to be on your side. If you have strong counts, then you have some more arguable counts that weakens the overall enterprise.
And remember, the other thing that you would always think about is here, the way that you charge it will impact the evidence that can come in at the trial in the Senate. And so it's really important to think about what evidence the House thinks is critically important that it have come before the American public as part of the trial. And that will dictate in some ways as well what the counts are. At this moment in time, you know, I've been thinking about it in terms of being very focused on Ukraine at this moment in time. And essentially, you know, we talked about this before for a moment, but maybe having more than one count related to Ukraine, I think there is a quid pro quo. And I certainly would want to see the House put in that evidence. I think it's very important. But I also think, like you do, you don't need a quid pro quo here. The president has violated his duty to the American public. And
but do you have a separate article of impeachment on quid pro quo? You think yes?
I think yes. At this moment in time, I would think you would have probably at least two or three articles of impeachment related to the effort by the president to exert political influence for his personal gain, right, in the 2020 election. And I also see obstruction counts here. And there are different levels of the obstruction that I would see, most particularly this idea of like putting the calls in other spaces, like sort of squirreling away the calls, but also potentially, and I want to think more about this, not complying with Congress.
I agree with you on two. I'm not sure about one. To the extent they're asking for the calls that have been squirreled away in the secret server, then I think that supports an article of impeachment in the second way that you described.
Yes.
And by the way, those were articles of impeachment in Nixon's case.
Right. I agree.
I think the hard question is putting aside Ukraine. And I asked this of George Conway, and he had a particular view. I'm curious what your view is. Having had this Mueller investigation and volume two of his report, which sets forth a lot of potential articles of impeachment based on obstruction, and the 1,000 prosecutors, you and I didn't sign, but 1,000 prosecutors, former prosecutors did, saying these were clear crimes that the president could be charged with were he not the sitting president, and we did not have the OLC guidance. Do you add those in here? And I think the answer to that is not legal, but political and strategic. I think George Conway's view was you add them in. It would seem odd not to add them in, given how many people said that they constitute evidence of a crime. But I think as a political matter, it weakens the Ukraine stuff, which is more recent, I think, in the minds of many people, whether it's fair or not, more urgent and still developing.
I agree with that.
What do you think about the Mueller stuff?
Yeah, I agree with that. I mean, it's so complicated because I was someone who favored going forward. After the Mueller report came out, I did believe that there had been sufficient evidence to warrant, you know, if I'd been a prosecutor, I would have taken a number of those obstruction counts to the grand jury. What I think is complicated now is that, so as a pure legal matter, do I think it would be legitimate and lawful for the House to do it? The answer is yes. I mean, there's, in my view, sufficient evidence. Do I think it's the right strategic and political move at this point in time? My instinct is no. And I want to think more about it because, again, I was someone who was critical of Pelosi for not moving quickly after the Mueller report came out to bring those forward. But it's been a long time now since the Mueller report came out. You know, he turned it in, I believe it was March, and it was sort of released in April. We're now sitting in October, soon to be November. And it feels to me like being streamlined and focused and clear about the harm and the issue here is really important. I'm starting to really make a distinction that I think is probably just more of a political public one than it is a legal one, which is that there's a lot to be said about the fact that the Ukraine incident involves the next election. And there's a real current ongoing harm, whereas the Mueller is a look back. And I think the reason Mueller is important is because that election interference relates directly to this election interference, but they are different in some ways, at least in the minds of the public. And so I want to think more about it, but and I want to know what your views are, but I would be really cautious about overly complicating this and making about too many things.
So at this moment, I am a reluctant believer that you stick to Ukraine. Because look, there was the opportunity to proceed, you know, speedily on impeachment after the Mueller report came out, and there was not a consensus. And so if you're thinking, it's sort of like the test in the grand jury, in some ways, you know, the public writ large and even some moderate Democrats and even the Speaker of the House and certainly Republicans weren't feeling it with respect to the Mueller stuff, even if other people were. And they seem to be feeling it, to pick a legal technical phrase, with respect to the Ukraine business. So I think you stick with that. I think you make it harder for moderates and Republicans to go along if you throw in all the Mueller stuff. It also seems, you know, this is not a good basis. This is not a statement of principle. So I hate to say it, but since it's a political process, not a legal process, I mean, if we were criminal prosecutors, you would put it all in, probably.
Right.
It's a little bit old.
Yeah.
And I think it's sort of been adjudicated publicly in a way that a lot of Trump opponents don't like, but it kind of has been.
Yeah, I agree with that. I also think there's another piece that's coming, which is that we haven't seen the Inspector General report yet on whether the FISAs were legitimately issued as during the Trump campaign and whether the FBI investigation into the president in 2016 was legitimate. The Inspector General is still working on that report. We know, as we just talked about, that Bill Barr, the Attorney General, who I think has been deeply partisan and problematic, but nevertheless is still the sitting Attorney General. He has this separate investigation being led by the Connecticut U.S. Attorney. So they're still litigating in some ways the 2016 election. They're complicating it in some ways. And again, I don't want to prejudge what particularly the Inspector General's report will say, but there is something about there's a level of complication and a lack of clarity around that, not for you and I when it comes to obstruction, but for the American public, that you don't want to put that in your trial. What you want in that trial is to be able to say the president did something wrong. He's trying to influence the future election. He's using the money that Congress has allocated and his own personal power to benefit himself politically, and we can't do that. And that feels like a much better narrative.
It's also harder, it seems to me, to attack the propriety of the investigation into the Ukraine business. I mean, the best they have, as far as I can tell right now, is the whistleblower is somehow partisan, even though everything the whistleblower said is completely accurate and has been corroborated. And second, Adam Schiff did this, you know, exaggeration, parody.
Dramatic reading
where
he wasn't
exaggerated
on a podcast.
He wasn't. And that's it.
Yep.
Now,
and they've changed their defense so frequently that it's clear they don't really have a defense, in my view. And so,
correct. Whereas on the other, you know, they had 2 years to figure out ways to attack the Mueller investigation. As you say, you have this IG report that hasn't yet come out. You know, would Mueller have to testify if you had articles of impeachment relating to obstruction? I bet now, having seen what happened last time, and I hate to say this also, I think Republican managers for the president would want to call Mueller. I'm not sure how that would go. So I think stick to the new stuff. And there's plenty of it.
I agree. As the more we've talked about it, the more convinced I am that I would be very focused on Ukraine and any counts related to Ukraine, but I would stay away from the Mueller report in 2016.
Now, what if, for example, the Doral decision had not been reversed and we were proceeding with, you know, setting up the G7 at the president's own property? Separate impeachable offense, article of impeachment or not?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. What was very clear, I think, is that Congress was going to move on the Doral piece, that they were going to bring it into an investigation that they were already doing. And so it felt to me like it would already be handled in some ways. And I don't want to say that I don't think anything should be added beyond Ukraine, but it would have to rise to a real level of corruption that was provable, that was very clear in my view. And so, you know, Doral, I think, is just outrageous on its face and absurd that they would pick it. But when I heard that Congress was looking at it and was bringing it into an investigation they were doing, I was not of the mind at that moment in time that it had to be an article of impeachment. Again, I think that focus and simplicity matters a lot. And the thing about Ukraine is that, and we don't know as much about the inner workings of the Doral yet, and maybe part of why they reversed is that there was going to be a deep inquiry into how that decision got made. And so
there still should be, by
there
the
still
way.
Should be, agreed. And there may be something that comes out that makes it clear that it needs to be, it really does hurt the U.S. interest. But Ukraine is at such a high level of obvious using, the president abusing his power, that it just feels to me, and it's such a significant way, trying to basically hold 400 million of aid for a country that desperately needs that aid unless they investigate one of his political rivals just feels to me like at such a high level. And so I would want...
And in a way that makes Russia happy.
Yes. Yes, exactly. Right. So if you're going to add something, it has to be at that level. Otherwise, it's complicating. And, you know, again, if we think about what you want the trial to look like, I think something like the Doral would be eclipsed by the Ukraine piece and would actually be maybe even distracting.
So the other thing that's going on that we haven't had a chance to get to yet, and we can, you know, cover quickly and summarize, is while all these other shenanigans are going on and while Mick Mulvaney is saying things and then retracting them and then not retracting them, witnesses are coming in to testify behind closed doors and having their depositions taken, some of whom are still in office, some of whom are not, some of whom are doing it over the objections of the White House. And so all this evidence is being developed. And I think one other thing that should happen, at least in my view, I'm wondering what you think, is before there is a vote on impeachment or vote on articles of impeachment, with respect to some of these witnesses, there need to be public hearings where sort of the highlights of the testimony that are both, you know, inculpatory of the president and also exculpatory of the president happen in the open and not just behind closed doors. I don't think you want to, at the end of the day, just have a report or articles based on behind closed doors depositions of them. You know, they're going through, like other investigations have been done, like that I participated in, getting as much evidence from as many people as possible. And then there need to be a series of public hearings so public sentiment comes along too.
Yeah, that's the way I would imagine it happening. I mean, I think the only other way is to release the depositions, frankly, because the House cannot vote on articles of impeachment without the public understanding what evidence there is that they believe supports it. And in a way that's fair, that both provides the information that they think supports it and potentially information that doesn't support it. And so there has to be a public process that for this to be legitimate, I believe needs to happen. And so what that looks like, I assume, and I've just been making that assumption that it would be hearings, and maybe that's not the right assumption. I'll think more about what the other options are. But I think there does have to be a public vetting of this. And I don't think it's fair to ask members to go in and cast their vote unless there's some process by which the American public understands. This is, you and I have talked about this before, but it's worth just highlighting. Impeachment is an incredibly serious thing, and it hasn't happened very often in the United States of America. And so the public has to understand, and members of the House of Representatives who vote need to have confidence also that the public understands what's happening. And so I think there's a process element here that's really, really important.
So a few people have come in and testified. We don't know the full extent of what they said. We talked last week on the show, our expectation that the ambassador to the EU, Gordon Sondland, would testify. He ended up testifying.
Yes, he ended up testifying. It's really interesting. And again, he was there for a very long time and we don't know exactly what he said. What he basically released a statement up front that made it appear, and I call this a little bit of the admit what you can't deny, deny what you can't admit defense, which is the, yes, I was in it, but I was doing this because the president directed me to work with Rudy Giuliani. But I was upset about the way that the ambassador, Marie Yovanovitch, the way that she was treated. And he's trying to walk the line of basically saying, yes, I did this political stuff with Ukraine and I was involved in it, but I did it because the president told me to do it and I support the State Department employees. And part of it, I think, is really important, which is that he was very explicit in saying the president directed that we work with Giuliani. The part that I didn't find credible, and just to get your input on this, he makes this sort of argument that, yes, I knew that there was an investigation into Burisma, this company in which Hunter Biden was a board member. I knew there was an investigation into that, but I didn't know it was connected to the Bidens.
Right. I didn't connect the dots.
It's a little too cute when at the time that he's the EU ambassador, but he's overseeing Ukraine. The president has hand-selected he and Rick Perry. You know, there's a very small group of people who've been personally selected to be in charge of this. And there are articles being written last summer about the Burisma connection to the Bidens and the fact that the president has been pushing for this investigation. And so if it's a surprise to him, that's a stunning thing. What did you make?
So he's mixed. He's a mixed witness. He's trying to save himself. He's also trying not to overtly lie. And we've used this term a couple times in the show. I think we'll use it a lot more because it's happening a bunch, threading the needle.
Yes.
And trying to put the best face on this because he's seeing, I think, you know, where things are going. And that's why I think some of these other people are defying the White House party line and they're coming forward and they want to say their piece and they don't want to look like they're obstructing and they also don't want to look like they're carrying the water for someone else because I think they're beginning to see how quickly you get thrown under the bus.
Yeah. And by the way, he directly points the finger at the president, and he came forward completely on that. The thing he didn't do was acknowledge, he minimized his role and how much he was in the politics, I think, of doing this. And what he wants to say is, I was doing it. I just didn't know that we were doing this to hurt Joe Biden.
You know, Sondland is in the hotel business, right? Do you think he's trying to get the G7?
Maybe he should go back to the hotel business and try to get the G7.
Maybe he has the perfect property.
He's in hospitality.
For the G7. And I think may be again very soon.
And by the way, we should say this also, in case people are quick to try to paint witnesses as good or bad, he is a mixed witness, and there's a lot he gives that I think is truthful and important. And then there's a place where he has an enormous self-interest in minimizing his role. And, you know, it's the job of the House managers of impeachment, if this goes forward, to be able to understand and explain that to people, that both things can be true.
Yeah,
he can both be telling the truth and trying to minimize his wrongdoing.
In real life, that happens all the time, right? The people who know about a scheme, the people who know about the bad conduct that happened, there's this view sometimes that the good guys are always the ones who were pure and heroic. Maybe the whistleblower was, maybe he wasn't, but they're pure and heroic, and they witness something and they come forward and they sound the alarm and then they give the evidence, and that they're pure. But often you have people who are a little bit in and a little bit out and probably cross some lines, and they're a mixed bag. And cases have been put together, you and I have both done, where a series of mixed bag witnesses plus corroborating evidence like texts and emails,
yes,
and phone calls that have transcripts, you put it all together and you tell a story, and it's not always perfect, the story. In fact, you know, no trial I've ever been a part of has been as perfect and beautiful as Donald Trump claims his call was. It's always a little messy because people are messy.
But to your point, and I think this is really important for people to remember, there are text messages with Sondland. There are witnesses who will say Sondland was in this meeting and raised these questions and investigations. And so, you know, at the end of the day, there'll be a lot of evidence that makes it clear what happened. And again, that shows in ways in which he's come forward and ways in which he's not completely acknowledged his role.
The most important thing in Sondland's testimony to me is what he did not say. He did not come out swinging in favor of the president, saying there's nothing to see here. Everything was great. Everything was wonderful. Everything was beautiful. What is wrong with you? How dare you? How dare you impugn my integrity, the president's integrity? Which, if everything was great, you might have expected that.
Yeah.
And he didn't do that. And a parade of people who don't do that.
He said the opposite. He said there was too much politics. I mean, he's the political appointee, but he.
But if you just see how the hearings will unfold, I'm trying to picture in my head, if there's a witness, I'm not talking about a member of Congress or Jim Jordan, whether he's wearing a jacket or not wearing a jacket, but, you know, somebody who's involved in the facts and who was a witness to the events and the conversations, is there a witness who's going to come forward and in a full-throated, you know, Mick Mulvaney way, with knowledge of the proceedings, going to come forward and say this was all perfect and great and wonderful? And I can't think of a person who will do that.
Yeah. And in fact, they're not going in, right? So to your point, you know, Pence has not agreed to cooperate with this, with the investigation. Rick Perry has not agreed to cooperate with the investigation. And so the people who you and I might think would go in and give a full-throated defense of the president have said, we're not going to be a part of it. And, you know, that, in my view, falls against them. It falls against their, how strong those arguments are.
Rhetorically and otherwise, it's a point to be emphasized. If the only people who are saying everything was great are politicians who have a partisan purpose, that's one thing. Listen to what the witnesses are saying and listen to what the witnesses are not saying. Another gentleman came in to testify in front of the House, George Kent, not Clark, but George.
Yes.
Deputy Assistant Secretary of State in the Bureau of European and Eurasian Affairs. He says a lot of things, among them that there is a group of people who basically sidelined him on Ukraine policy. And the three people were the three amigos.
Yes. The European Union Ambassador Gordon Sondland, Energy Secretary Rick Perry, and Special Envoy, U.S. Envoy to Ukraine, Kurt Volker.
We should pause on Rick Perry is leaving.
Yes. He's now leaving. He's tired of being blamed for everything.
Do you think Dancing with the Stars has a policy that you can only be on as a former government official one time? Or do you think he can be on again?
I don't know whether I hope they do or they don't. I'm a mixed witness on that, both because I would not like to see it and because I probably could not help myself but watch. So Ken testified, and it's important both that he was sidelined because it sort of shows the rise of politics in the State Department dealings with Ukraine. It's also important that he really talked about the fact that Giuliani's involvement and how he was pushed out of this. It does make a difference in sort of this bigger narrative of who was running Ukraine policy and who was in charge of it. And it's clear that it was a very political effort and that the people in charge of it, that they were trying to get the career state folks out of the picture. And what's also important to me is that the career state folks are the very people who'd been responsible for actually fighting corruption in Ukraine. The ambassador who was pushed out, Marie Yovanovitch, George Kent, who's minimized. And so at the end of the day, I think it's going to paint a picture of there are people who really do care about corruption in Ukraine and trying to do the right thing there. They're all pushed aside in favor of the president's handpicked politicos who he tells to basically listen to Giuliani.
I mean, I think about all this as we start to move into the posture of thinking about an impeachment proceeding vote and a trial in the Senate. That once upon a time, people might have thought that the only evidence you had of this bad conduct was that phone call that the whistleblower cited. And it's very difficult, even if all the evidence you need and all the elements are made out with respect to one phone call, there are ambiguities you can argue even if they're not good faith arguments to make. The problem for the president here is there's so much other meat.
Right.
There's so many other subplots, all of which further the main plot.
Yeah, they all go in the same direction.
Yeah, which is they wanted, again, it's very simple. And for all people who are arguing with their friends, wherever you have these kinds of arguments and discussions, and all the names are hard to keep straight. You know, we sort of do this for a living, and it's sometimes hard to keep straight what everyone's title is. The fundamental thing to remember is the President of the United States appears to have tried to pressure a foreign government to do an investigation of his rival, and it's possible that it was even worse than that, that he did it by withholding substantial hundreds of millions of dollars in aid to that country in a quid pro quo. And the question is, when you hear new evidence come to light and new testimony being revealed, does it support that conclusion? And if it does, that's worse for the president, and it adds meat to the bones, and it's not just a conclusory bit of evidence that you put forward.
I think this is the whole problem for the president, which is that in order to do this, he had to sideline the entire apparatus of the United States government that usually deals with Ukraine. And he had to change the way we're doing business and put his own personal, whether he's really acting as his attorney or not, but put his own personal attorney in. And at the end of the day, there's so much evidence of how it was done and what was done. The call is just the sort of crystallizing moment where the president makes the ask of the foreign leader.
It's the thing that's missing from other places.
Yes.
It puts him in it.
Yes,
personally.
Exactly. If we didn't have that call, it would be very easy for the president basically to distance himself from, I don't know what Rudy was doing. I hadn't told him to do this. I don't know what Perry's doing. But it puts him, it makes him the leader of this.
Right. And you think
effort.
About what the summation is going to be. And you always, maybe we should talk about it in the future. You know, we would talk about what the summation would be at
Day
the time
one.
You filed the criminal complaint or indictment. And I would say to people, from time to time on a closer case, you know, hum a few bars of the summation. Like, how are we going to argue this, particularly if it's circumstantial evidence, which is perfectly acceptable and usable in court. People don't always appreciate that. Just as good as direct evidence. Some circumstantial evidence is really, really, really powerful. And you'd say, well, how are you going to argue this? And one way you're going to argue this is if everything was on the up and up, if everything was so normal and ordinary and beautiful and perfect, and those words are going to come back to haunt the president, everything's so beautiful and perfect, then why is an outsider? Then why sideline the people? Then why have a separate server? And there's 20 more questions you can ask like that.
Yep.
And you would expect that the people who are pressing the case in the Senate will make those points, and they'll do it in front of the American public, and it will be compelling.
It's a great point, because even if they try to proffer an answer to each one of those, they will not all stick together, right? By the time you get to question three,
There's an accumulation.
There's an accumulation. And I think the depth of the evidence here is something we haven't seen before. And that's what makes it
so
powerful.
By the way, I didn't really expect this depth of evidence. We first heard about the call.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Or maybe it's to put it slightly differently, I had no faith that this accumulation of evidence would come forward.
I think that's a better way to say it. Because I think if we'd sort of thought about what got to that call, it would have been clear that there were a number of steps. I just didn't anticipate how much of that would become public information, how many people would come forward. Can I ask one of the listener questions that came up? And I think it's important to talk about this in the as we're doing this right now, which is we got a question about shadow diplomacy from Seth Roby, at Seth Roby on Twitter, at Preet Bharara, at Ann Milgram. Do Rudy's actions as a shadow diplomat violate Congress's role to advise and consent on cabinet and senior officials? And it goes on to sort of think about what stops a president of the United States from nominating an empty suit secretary of state, but then using his buddies for diplomacy, hashtag ask Preet, hashtag ask Ann. Should we be – here's my question. I'm going to put my question with Seth. Should we be calling this shadow diplomacy?
I don't know exactly what that means. I mean, I've been using that term also.
I don't like it.
It's not a technical term.
Yeah.
Well, because it doesn't look like it's diplomacy.
Exactly. I feel like we're legitimizing.
I think from time to time – it happens that a president of the United States and the foreign policy establishment will decide, in the interest of the United States of America, we are going to ask a former president or somebody of substantial respect to go help
to
us.
Be an emissary.
To be an emissary.
Yes.
Or you put them
in different, right? In my view.
But if you're going to have somebody who's helping the government, that's one thing. If you're going to have somebody who's trying to help your own personal interests, who, by the way, also has clients.
Yes.
In lots of different places who may conflict. I mean, part of the reason that you do these things internally is to make sure that they're conflict-free.
Yes.
If you're the Secretary of State or you're an ambassador, you're not allowed to have other employment and other interests and other people paying your salary so that you represent only the United States of America. Rudy Giuliani represents himself, at the same time representing members of foreign governments, leaders of foreign governments, criminals who he's trying to get pardoned or sent back to the originating country like Turkey, and at the same time, as opposed to in good faith, being doing things on behalf of the United States of America, it doesn't work. And I think he's in a load of trouble because of it.
Yeah, I agree. So first of all, I don't think it's diplomacy, and I think we should stop calling it shadow diplomacy because it almost makes it feel legitimate to me. Like
shadow dancing? Should we call it that?
Can you play that song now?
Nobody knows what song you're talking about.
Isn't there a song?
There is.
Yeah.
But from a long time ago.
Yeah, I'm old. Okay. The second
the
point.
Bee Gees.
The Bee Gees. Yeah. The second point on Rudy. Preet just made a great face like, man,
our team is like,
you're old and you're not cool.
Who the hell are these people and who gave them a podcast?
Here's the other point on Rudy. It's about the president trying to use his guy outside of government to get something done. Because the president could have put Rudy in the State Department and he didn't. And he didn't want to. And there's a way in which this is an intentional circumvention of the way that the State Department and U.S. diplomacy works. And so
that's the way you can describe the entire presidency. It's a circumvention of protocols, policies, checks and balances, and everything else. That's the point.
That is the point. I'm going to try to come up with in the next week another term other than, unless you have one now,
no.
Shadow diplomacy. Because I don't want to buy into this idea that there's something diplomatic and legitimate about trying to pressure a foreign government to do your personal political bidding.
There's a lot of news. Keeps developing. We'll keep trying to explain it.
Yeah, great to see you. Please send us your questions.
And we'll try to answer them. This is the Cafe Insider Podcast. Your hosts are Preet Bharara and Ann Milgram. The executive producer is Tamara Sepper. The senior producer is Aaron Dalton. And the Cafe team is Carla Pierini, Julia Doyle, Calvin Lord, David Kurlander, and Jeff Eisenman. Our music is by Andrew Dost. Thank you for being a part of the Cafe Insider community.